The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts. It should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine, our new mini-series on substance use disorders. I'm Dr. Carolyn Chan, and I am joined by my fabulous co-host today, Dr. Natalie Stahl and Dr. Paul Williams. On tonight's episode, we'll discuss harm reduction with Dr. Kim Su. But before we get started with that, Natalie, will you tell the audience what we do on this show?
Sure, Carolyn. We are the internal medicine podcasts for all things addiction medicine. We use expert interviews to bring you teaching pearls and practice-changing knowledge to help clinicians everywhere provide evidence-based care for individuals with addiction. And a reminder that most episodes are available for free CME through VCU Health CE for all health professionals, and that's at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account.
Special thanks to the American College of Academic Addiction Medicine, also known as ACAM, who have partnered with us to help support the Curbsiders Addiction Medicine miniseries. ACAM is the proud home for academic addiction medicine faculty and trainees, and they are committed to supporting and training the next generation of addiction medicine leaders. Learn more about their organization at their website, acam.org, which is ACAAM.org.
And tonight, I'm excited to tell you about our fabulous guest, the amazing Dr. Kim Su, who talks to us all about harm reduction. Dr. Su is a physician anthropologist, as you'll hear about the questions that she asks. She is an author. She's the medical director of the National Harm Reduction Coalition. Dr. Su is also a practicing board-certified internal medicine and addiction medicine physician and an assistant professor of medicine at Yale University School of Medicine. Her book, Getting Wrecked, Women, Incarceration, and the American Opioid Crisis, looks at how women with opioid use disorders navigate the criminal legal system in Massachusetts. Dr. Su taught us a bunch of stuff, which include things like, first of all, just believing and partnering with patients and asking them questions about their substance use in a way that facilitates ongoing discussion so that we can then apply the lenses of harm reduction. She talked about specific strategies in terms of mitigating harm in terms of routes of administration and how patients use drugs, and discussed how harm reduction is not necessarily having abstinence as its key tenet, but rather it's a way to sort of help patients thrive and just maintain and prolong their health. So it's much, much more than giving out naloxone. It's a way of partnering with patients and helping them live the life that they're hoping to live. So without further ado, let's get into it.
Hey, Kim, thanks so much for being on the show. Let's start with a few rapid fire questions to get to know you better. Can you please give us a one-liner to describe yourself?
So I'm a 37-year-old lady. I live in New Haven, Connecticut, and I'm an addiction medicine doctor and an internal medicine doctor at Yale. I'm an assistant professor in the Yale University School of Medicine and the medical director of the National Harm Reduction Coalition.
Okay. And just to get to know you a little bit better, what is the most adventurous thing you've ever done?
I think that would be snorkeling in Belize in the path of a boat.
Kim, that sounds terrifying.
The most adventurous.
Well, wait, but was this by intention? Was this part of the snorkeling experience, or did you just happen to find yourself in front of a boat? I'm looking for clarity.
So I decided I was going to go out alone on a solo snorkeling trip, and not intentionally, but I discovered that I was in the path of the trail of the boats, you know, the boat road.
How big was the boat?
It wasn't big, but you know, it was. I also encountered a big stingray and thought I was going to have a Steve Irwin moment, you know. And I had a come to Jesus moment where I was okay with my death.
Any follow up questions?
We also know you love animals, Kim. Do you have any pets?
Yes, I have a 4-year-old rescue dog who is a beagle named Poppy Sue.
Does her name have any particular origin, Poppy Sue?
Just the flower.
That's great. So why don't we move on to part two and kind of start with a case from Cashlack Memorial. So Natalie, do you mind helping introduce a case today that we can really use to help our learners and listeners learn more about harm reduction?
Sure. So Mr. Meacham is a 46-year-old gentleman who comes to an acute clinic session for an arm abscess. He has a past medical history of endocarditis, asthma, and he is unhoused. He's guarded when you take a history, but acknowledges ongoing IV drug use. You determine he can be treated with an IND and oral antibiotics, but you want to learn more about his drug use to help him stay safer. So to kind of start off, we're here to talk about something called harm reduction. And can you tell us more about how you define it or how it's defined in general?
Yeah. So I define harm reduction in a micro and a macro sense. The micro sense is often what we do in the clinic. So I'd say it's a set of practical strategies and techniques that we can use to reduce the negative consequences associated with drug use. And there's also a macro lens, which takes into account that harm reduction is a movement that was started by people who use drugs, people who engage in sex work, that focuses on promoting the health and dignity of people who use drugs, on keeping people safe, and people being treated with dignity, respect, and compassion. So I toggle between those two lenses, especially as clinicians, we're working in the micro lens a lot. But at the same time, it sounds like this case has many details of the macro lens as well. So it's really important for people not to get fixated on harm reduction as any one thing. Harm reduction is not just naloxone. It's not just sterile syringes. It is housing first. It is access to food and resources. So I want people to think expansively about it and to think about it also as a social movement.
So that's terrific. And before we kind of get into specific elements of harm reduction, I did want to ask, so in the stem of the question, so Mr. Meacham is guarded on his history. It sounds like he's a little bit hesitant to answer our question. So it sounds, I think I'm inferring that maybe he's already experienced a little bit of stigma associated perhaps with his drug use. But I think more broadly, would you mind talking to why someone who uses drugs might avoid initially seeking medical care?
Yeah, this is a great question. So this has been studied quite significantly, and we know there's several common themes about why people who use drugs don't come to seek care. Some, and often, they've been mistreated in the past. So they've experienced judgment, they've experienced hostility, they've been blamed for their own drug use by healthcare providers. They sometimes don't realize that what they're dealing with is a serious infection, or they try to manage it on their own. Many people are actually afraid that their drug use, if they have children or other people involved, is going to involve child protective services or police. Many people who have involvement with the carceral system, who might have warrants, who might be on probation and parole, are afraid of coming into contact with the healthcare system. And many people say that being in the hospital is just as bad, if not worse, than being incarcerated. We do also know that people who use drugs are often not treated for pain. They're often not treated for withdrawal, and they feel as if their complaints aren't taken seriously, that doctors really fixate on substance use and don't attend to the problem that they feel like they're bringing to the table. They don't feel believed. So those are some common themes about why people who use drugs don't come to see us.
And do you have any tips for clinicians? How do we make more patient-centered environments for folks who use substances?
This is a great question. Just to clarify, are we talking about in a patient encounter, or are we talking about how to make our clinics friendly to people who use drugs more generally?
I'm going to already borrow the two lenses you gave us earlier, the micro and the macro. So I'm going to ask, could you give us an example of each?
Yes. So I'll give an example of a micro, which is telling people that you believe them, or that you're asking, you know, questions about their substance use, really because you care about them getting better and taking care of the issue X that they bring to, you know, to the table. And that issue X is going to be addressed. And so often people really feel like you are not going to address the issue that they want to talk about or want to take care of. The second thing, so maybe a macro level thing that you can do in your clinic, is have friendly messaging, have signage. You're always welcome to talk to me about drugs. There are a variety of things that people can buy as signposts that substance use is a normal thing to talk about, and it's part of achieving, you know, greater health.
So in terms of that microlens again, I think a lot of us didn't really get trained on real ways about how to talk to patients about substance use. So we often are kind of limited to asking them how much they use, or and maybe our education is limited to information that they should stop or that abstinence is important. So when you first meet a patient, do you have an opening spiel? Like you kind of mentioned talking about explaining why you're asking. Is there anything else that you think is really important or important hallmarks to keep the conversation non-judgmental?
One thing I start off a lot is these are questions that we ask everybody. That does normalize the conversation. It makes it not like I'm looking at you and I'm discriminating against you. I think you're X. I think you're doing Y. So if you can normalize it, that really starts you off on a better footing. I also always ask people, you know, explain to them why I'm asking, that I'm not just asking because I'm nosy. I'm asking because if you're using a bundle of heroin and fentanyl a day, that tells me a lot of information. That tells me that the dose of morphine I'm going to use to take care of your, you know, pain is not adequate, right? So I explain to people why I need to know what I need to know. And I also ask people what's their goal in regards to their substance use. And I let people lead, and I want it to be a conversation. So it really does depend a little bit on your setting, and it depends on how much time you have to have that real conversation. If you're in the outpatient and this is someone who's coming to establish primary care with you, you might not even talk about substance use on the first visit. You know, it might take 2, 3, 4 times to establish a relationship where you have the trust and they've been showing up and you've been showing up. So if it's an emergency room, where often that's the case, you might have to do it in a way that's truncated, but still respectful and compassionate, and gets the information you need and that you can work together with them.
So it sounds a little bit like context matters, and the conversation you would have with someone who's in acute pain from, say, an abscess that's maybe just been IND'd would be different than someone who's presenting to your office for treatment for opioid use disorder. It seems like those would be two different, entirely different discussions and histories, if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly.
Yeah. I think the context really does matter. I think that especially if people are in withdrawal, first of all, you know, sometimes you just have to treat the withdrawal and the pain first and come back. If people are super angry and agitated, screaming, really uncomfortable, they're in a lot of pain, you know, it's understandable that having a long conversation about naloxone or where they're injecting or how they can inject more safely, like they are not necessarily in the right frame of mind.
I think that's a really important point, because I know when I've been with trainees on our addiction medicine consult service, sometimes people are kind of astounded at the difference in how easy it is to talk to someone on day one when patients are so uncomfortable, and how treating pain and withdrawal can make such a big difference. And I think that one of the reasons that we don't see that enough sometimes might be because we undertreat pain and withdrawal so often. So not everyone kind of gets a chance to see that in a way. But I think that's a really important point to save some questions for later.
You guys have done an amazing job sort of establishing this non-judgmental environment with Mr. Meacham. So he does open up and sort of says that he's been using IV heroin, possibly some fentanyl, for about 15 years. He doesn't share any of his needles, but he has had periods of decreased opioid use while he was on methadone treatment. But he really found it hard to stay in and on methadone due to transportation issues that he was having. He has tried buprenorphine naloxone on the street to self-treat withdrawal, and he's really found it helpful. So, Kim, I'm curious, how would you counsel this patient on safer injection practices?
Well, Mr. Meacham sounds like an expert already. So I'm looking at the case and I'm thinking, this guy's been injecting for 15 years. So I always start off with a conversation about, walk me through your injecting practice, or can you tell me how you inject, or can you show me how you inject? Because this guy, if he's been injecting heroin or fentanyl, let's say 3 to 4 times a day. He knows how he has a practice, and whether that practice is sterile all the time, whether that practice is using a new syringe every time, it's not certain. So I love people to walk me through what they do. They are experts, right? They are very experienced at doing this. They've often done it for other people, and in many cases, we do know that they haven't necessarily learned, from the textbooks. They might have learned from other people. They might have learned from partners. So it's important for us to know as well. So I'll walk you through some of the things that I think about when I'm counseling someone on safer injection, as if they've not done it before, but Mr. Meacham, it sounds like he has. So one thing that I recommend that patients do off the bat is wash their hands. This became really clear during COVID when we were doing a lot of harm reduction training where we were like really worried about how it was transmitted. So we paid special attention to hand washing in March 2020. That's always the case. I also talk to patients about drug set setting. So this might not seem to be part of safer injection practices, but it really is. So if you can imagine if someone is injecting and they're in withdrawal, they're in a bathroom, a public bathroom, it may be dark, it may be not well lit, they may not have enough time, they're much more likely to miss a vein, or they're much more likely to use a non-sterile technique. So I do encourage people to get in a setting where they can relax, where they can take their time, where they can be calm, ideally when they have someone who is going to keep an eye out for them. So that drug set setting piece is really part and integral to safer injection practices, right? Then, granularly walking through how people have their substance, they prepare a powder, they prepare a substance. Ideally, they're preparing it with water that's sterile or sterile, packets that you can obtain from a syringe service program. They are using a filter that when they find a vein, that they take care to find veins in the arms region, and they rotate their veins. And if they have difficulty finding a vein, that they can use a warm compress, they can use some heat, some warm water to bring up a vein. They then clean off their skin. They tie a tourniquet. If they don't have a tourniquet, they can use a sock or something else. And the tourniquet's on. The tourniquet's important to bring the vein up so that you're more likely to succeed. Then you're kind of inserting your substance. We want it to be bevel up towards the heart, 25 degree angle. Register to make sure you're in a vein and you get flash. Release the tourniquet and inject their drugs. We want to encourage people to not slam it, to go slowly. And take the needle out, apply pressure, and then engage in aftercare or disposal of the syringe.
So you mentioned some supplies that people might get from syringe exchange programs, and I imagine that sometimes this might be hard for, and if not Mr. Meacham, but other people who are newer to injecting to take all in. Are there certain resources that you offer people, or how do people kind of know where they can go usually?
Yeah, I would encourage people to check out the website for nextdistro.org, which we can put in the show notes. It's an online mail-based program that can send equipment to people. You can look up your local syringe service program, and many of them do deliveries, or they can meet you, or they have storefronts. So that's how I'd encourage that. As prescribers, there's many things that we can actually prescribe of those things. We can prescribe wound care. We can prescribe syringes. We can prescribe sterile water. So these are things that we might be able to get to our patients without them having to go procure them elsewhere.
And Kim, are there, a basic level, are there any legal concerns with prescribing patients syringes or sterile water if it's explicitly for injection drug use, say, I guess how does one go about that?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes it can be hit or miss. I haven't encountered any legal issues, knock on wood, but I'm not a lawyer. But in my practice, it does actually end up being a little bit about what the pharmacy will have on stock and what they can supply, or a standard set of insulin syringes. You can write in the notes like, you know, for sterile injection, for sterile use, for sterile injection use. You know, you don't have to be specific or explicit about that. You don't have to lie if someone is not diabetic. I think depending on which pharmacy you use, depending on your relationship with your pharmacist, it would be nice to cultivate those relationships with your local pharmacist that can help you and understand that they are an important part of engaging and improving the healthcare of people who use drugs. And I usually like to give them in, you know, the boxes that people need them in or procure them in like hundreds.
And I think, too, to add on to that point, Kim, you know, so many of my patients have pointed out, like, there may be great local resources in your community that already exist. Like, know what they are, know what the hours are, how can you reach them? I've had some patients who just didn't know, you know, our local syringe exchange existed. So I think just even having that information and to be available to your patients is just really could be very helpful for some.
Mm-hmm. I would recommend that everyone kind of figure out where your local or nearest syringe service program or harm reduction agency is. Just even if you're not able to actually go there or visit or chat with them, that you're going to send them referrals and it's going to, you know, help build rapport and engagement with people.
And we can put some information in the show notes about where you can start that search as well, because there are some great resources out there to kind of put in your address and see what the closest ones are.
For Mr. Meacham, it was interesting to me that he has been on treatment for opioid use disorder. He's been on methadone, he's been on buprenorphine naloxone, but it sounds like he was still using opioids, using other full agonist opioids on top of those medications. So I'm curious if somebody is still, you know, using other substances, other non-prescribed substances while they're taking like methadone or buprenorphine naloxone. Does that mean the medication isn't working for them? How would you approach thinking about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is actually right out of one of the cases in the buprenorphine waiver training, which is the first case where you have a jazz musician and a lawyer who, you know, occasionally uses heroin on top of buprenorphine, right? So again, this comes to the question of us assessing patient safety and us understanding people's goals in relation to their substance use. And abstinence is not always the goal. It often is. And whatever people's goal is, whether it's controlled use, whether they want to use on the weekends, and, you know, I want to understand all those things and help keep people safe, alive, and healthy. And that's what people want, you know, as well, too. So absolutely, you know, taking medication for opioid use disorder is life-saving. And if he is using full agonist opioids on top, I want to understand why. I want to understand, is his dose not, is it not appropriate? Is he still having cravings? Are there other contexts in which he's using that he's needing to deal with a certain situation, or that he's experiencing some stress or some trauma? What's going on in his life? So this opens the door to having a lot of questions. I'm also going to ask about overdoses. I really want to understand has he experienced any overdoses, you know, and understand, does he feel safe, right? How risky is his additional use that's on top? And so if I could get a sense of that, then we can continue to work on improving some of those things and trying to make his keep him safe, really.
So I just want to make sure I understand. It seems like what you're saying is it's the right thing to keep prescribing, that buprenorphine prescribers don't need to feel like they need to always refer or stop, or certainly not cut someone off buprenorphine, or tell someone that they have to switch their treatment program if they're still using, that we should just engage with our patients and have that conversation.
Yeah, there's so many times too that you find out that one formulation has kind of unpalatable to them, and they really prefer another formulation, or that this thing really worked for them, and you know, it was a different branded product, and so sometimes you learn things like, oh wow, this person's actually not taking buprenorphine the way it's supposed to be absorbed, you know, they're actually swallowing it and they're losing bioavailability. So troubleshooting some stuff like that, really trying to understand, like, on a granular level, when do you take it? You know, are you taking it? Is it wearing off too soon? Or the ways people experience it. I think people are doing radically different things than, like, as prescribed with some of our medications. And I think it's really important that we be humble and we try to understand that people who use drugs might have, you know, done, you know, just whatever they wanted for the last 10 years, and they've never had to talk to their doctor about it, right? And they've been self-managing, you know, lives of enormous stress and difficulty, and have been quite resilient in that regard. So it is a learning process to, like, learn to work with a doctor and to try to report your symptoms when they're just so used to managing it or taking care of it themselves.
I think that's a great point, that it takes a process. Our healthcare system's complicated, and sort of being humble and leaving space to help navigate it for patients and really engage on a patient-centered level is really, really super critical. Luckily, Mr. Meacham, again, he's really built great rapport with you, and later tells you that he has some trouble getting going in the morning and smokes crack cocaine to sort of help wake him up. He notes that it really does exacerbate and aggravate his asthma, and he also knows other people who inject cocaine, so he wants to know your thoughts on which mode of use would be the safest for him. So I think to sort of kick off that, a little bit of a broader question is like, what are the different ways people actually use substances?
Yeah, I mean, the routes of administration is what we call the different ways that people take substances into their body. And we can think of them in terms of a general risk level, but we can't precisely say because they haven't necessarily been studied against each other. So from highest risk, you might say that injection is at the highest risk from both an overdose perspective and probably also from an infectious perspective. We also have other routes of administration that are less risky: rectal administration of drugs, smoking, insufflation or intranasal, snorting or sniffing, and eating. So those would be kind of the main overall buckets of ways that people are using substances, and going through those non-judgmentally and thinking about the fact that people are doing a lot of different substances, and that most people are not just, you know, doing one thing, and that they've actually probably gone through many of those things as they progress through their substance use across time. So talking to people about changing up the route of administration might be important if they're having particular risks or they're having difficulty hitting their veins, for example. We might suggest, have you ever tried any rectal administration? It might be popularly known as booty bumping, for example. And many patients have, actually, right? So, like, we need to know about these things because these are things that people are trying. We need to understand, you know, how to counsel them. We need to understand their experiences with them and how to keep them safe.
I think that in terms of harm reduction, I learned a lot more about harm reduction for opioids, for heroin or fentanyl, than I did about stimulants. So when someone tells me they're smoking crack cocaine, I don't know as much. I didn't learn as much about what to ask them or what resources might be helpful for them. Do you have favorite take-home information or things that you talk to patients about who use stimulants that we should know about?
Yes, this is a great question. So stimulants are really an under-recognized area that we need to talk about. We very focused on opioids with the number of opioid deaths we've been having, but stimulant deaths have been on the rise for the past 5 years or more. These are both cocaine and methamphetamine. excluding also opioids as well. So excluding polysubstance on their own, they're also rising in terms of deaths. So I think a couple things that I talk to people who are using stimulants about include recognizing sort of stimulant overdose, what we might call overamping in terms of in methamphetamine, and really recognizing when they've done too much and how to manage that, when to get medical attention for that. People, you know, it's sort of a spectrum, right? So people may be having increased energy, they may be having intrusive thoughts or psychosis or other things like that. And really, you know, trying to figure out, like, is this a medical emergency? Is this something that, you know, we can handle here at our house or in our party? Or is this something where, you know, we really, can we support this person through this substance use? Or, like, is this something that's a medical emergency? So again, if people are complaining of cardiovascular symptoms, anything, you know, anything like that seems like a stroke, seizure, obviously, these are obviously medical emergencies. Hyperthermia stimulants can cause as well. And so those are common reasons why we might see them in the emergency room. So I want to make sure that people recognize, you know, when to get help. We also know that this is something that I also talk to people about, which is that co-use of stimulants and opioids, uppers and downers at the same time, doesn't decrease your chance of overdose. So I really do, of opioid overdose, right? I mean, you're doing a lot of mixing. People are mixing to try to achieve a certain effect, but it doesn't necessarily decrease your chance of having an opioid overdose. A lot of people think it might counteract, it might you know, keep you awake, but I do worry about people who are mixing because we don't really know what's exactly going on, but they are still at very high risk of overdose. So I always want people to have naloxone ready if they're doing a lot of substances. And even if they are doing substances that they think are only cocaine or methamphetamine, I want them to have fentanyl test strips, because the cross-contamination is on the rise. So I want people to have naloxone on hand, even if they think they're using just stimulants.
Kim, when we think about equipment for injection use, you know, there's a syringe, there's a needle. I'm curious, are there any sort of parallels with stimulant use? Like, are there different equipment needs? And is there a way to make them safer?
Yes, thanks for asking. There are a wide variety of things that we can do to help out people who use stimulants. So a common thing for people who are smoking crack or cocaine is to give people Pyrex or glassware stems, is what we call them here, and a kit that is like a safer smoking kit might include a couple of these Pyrex. And the reason they're Pyrex is that the glass, you know, they don't chip or break as easily. They really can retain heat. They also come with some filter, like a Brillo, and sticks that people can push down the rock. And we also include condoms, and we include lubrication and stuff for people's mouth to keep saliva, so maybe even gum. And there's also a mouthpiece, really just to prevent burns, right? So we know that hepatitis C and other things like that can get transmitted when people are sharing smoking equipment. So we really want to emphasize mouth and nose care. With meth, they're bubble pipes that have so that the meth can come up that way.
I've heard people talk about a chore boy as a filter. Is that a different from a Brillo pad somehow?
You know, they're all just different kinds of filters for crack cocaine. Yeah.
I did want to ask about, while we're on the topic of sort of non-opioid substance use, I did want to ask, I feel like a lot of the times during the discussion around harm reduction, I don't hear, say, alcohol discussed as much, even though it still accounts for a huge proportion of morbidity, mortality, and working age adults. So I'm wondering, is there a way to use your harm reduction lenses to sort of counsel about alcohol use as well? And I might even ask the same question about tobacco use when you're done with alcohol.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of great tips on alcohol harm reduction, and I'm so glad that you brought up this point because it is one of the most widely used substances in this country. So for people that are trying to decrease the amount of alcohol that they're drinking, it's very important generally to count their drinks, to space their drinks, to make sure they're eating, that they've had food in their stomach, to take vitamins, really ways that having buddies, you know, accountability partners, and really setting in general for safer substance use, setting dollar amounts. And this will also go for smoking as well. It goes for, you know, smoking any substance or using any substance, just trying to set a dollar amount, trying to budget, you know, for the week, trying to think about how to keep themselves out of withdrawal, right? In many cases, we think about alcohol harm reduction as trying to keep people out of withdrawal and DTs. How do we keep people safe? You know, how do we keep people out of the hospital? Making sure that, you know, if they, you know, if their goal is not to black out, you know, how are you going to account for getting the drinks that you want, but not drinking to black out, you know, and like how are we going to do that? And people come up with creative ways that they can, you know, have other people watch out for them, or that they can have people, you know, watch their drinks or count their drinks, and thinking also about that drug set setting piece, right? Where is the setting that's going to be the safest for them? Is that going to be a bar where someone's going to be, a bartender might cut them off? You know, is that their friend's house where they don't have access to all the cabinets, you know, or what is that circumstance under which people are going to be the safest?
And what about tobacco?
So, you know, this is a really, you know, interesting point. Many people, you know, we're still debating in the evidence about if vaping is tobacco harm reduction, is effective and good means to decreasing, alternative to decreasing cigarettes. I think for some patients, I have seen some success for them, that they've been able to move off of cigarettes and try vaping. They've even been able to titrate down the amount of nicotine in there, you know, like they're on very low levels of nicotine. I think with any good harm reduction strategy is meeting people where they're at and saying, so how many cigarettes, you know, what is your goal with your smoking? You know, is your goal 4 cigarettes a day? Is your goal 1 cigarette a day? And how can we get you there? Utilizing nicotine replacement therapy obviously helps us, but what other strategies can we use? Like, where are you stumbling? I often ask people, walk me through a typical day. Like, when are you smoking? You know, like, when are you drinking? When are you smoking? When are you injecting? That day, that gives you so much information about, you know, their needs, about their cravings, about when their worst time is. Is their worst time sleeping? Is their worst time waking up? That can really help us understand where substances fit into people's lives and how we can make it safer.
I can totally tell you, you're an anthropologist. Walk me through your day. Just such a lovely open-ended question.
Walk me through your day, sir.
I hope sometimes you get conversations like I started with a bowl of Frosted Flakes and then proceeded to walk. I don't know if people ever get that detailed, but I kind of hope so sometimes.
It can get granular. It can get granular, which is nice.
That's great. I want to ask sort of like one other sort of piece. Mr. Meacham, you know, you talked and alluded to this a little bit earlier about his overdose risk. And unfortunately, he has had 2 overdoses over the past 5 years. And I'm curious, any thoughts about how you would counsel him and how to prevent another opioid overdose?
Right. So I would like to ask Mr. Meacham if he can walk me through the circumstances in which he overdosed. I find a lot of information from that. Was it the fact that he had just left prison and he had not been using for a period of time? Did he have a period of sustained abstinence? And then he hit a toxic street supply of now fentanyl, and which he thought back in the day was heroin. So that can happen. Every overdose, I think, is something that we can wrap our head around and try to figure out how could we have prevented that, right? All overdoses, in theory, are preventable. We have access to naloxone, a magical medication that literally can raise people from the dead. So if we could get those into the hands of everyone who's having an overdose, the 100,000 people that died of an overdose, we wouldn't be in the situation that we're in now. So I always make sure that they have naloxone, they know how to use it, that it's not expired. Really, also, you know, I ask them, are they using alone? So is Mr. Meacham using alone? If he is using alone, I'd encourage him to use the 1-800-NEVER-USE-ALONE hotline. I know that people use alone for a wide variety of reasons, right? Some people use alone because they don't want to share their stuff. Some people use alone because they're at risk of sexual violence. Some people, you know, there's many reasons why people use alone. And I'm not trying to say don't use alone. Obviously, if you can use with a buddy that can watch out for you and take turns, right? If you're both injecting your stuff at the same time, who's going to naloxone who? So there's some really practical stuff. I always talk to people about doing a test dose, which if you have a new substance, just go slow, right? You can always do more. You can never do less. People understand that. I tell people to avoid mixing. Really try to stagger. So wait, like, you know, if you are going to do cocaine and then do, you know, fentanyl, I'd try to have you wait a little bit and just see how you feel. So those are some practical tips. Obviously, having their own supplies and testing their resource, you know, testing their drugs if they have any fentanyl test strips, those would all be useful.
And just to circle back your other points, there's a lot of contamination of fentanyl in our stimulant supply. So every patient who's using stimulants also should be prescribed naloxone, which is really, really unfortunate, but it's something that I think really should be like the new standard of practice.
And benzodiazepines too.
Definitely.
People using anything from... I wanted to ask for the Never Use Alone hotline, is that a person on the other end? Is it, how does that work? Is it really open all the time? How do people know it's not the cops?
Yeah, it's a good question. I actually called it myself when I was doing research for a toolkit that I was making, the Pregnancy and Substance Use Toolkit. I called it. And really, it's staffed by people who've been affected by overdose. It's a volunteers. It's staffed by wonderful people, including a former EMS guy. And it really is someone who sits on the line with you. Most of the time, they just chat with you. And I've heard Stephen Murray from the Never Use Alone group talk about how he just tells you practical things from a paramedic standpoint, like, don't block the door, like, don't use up against the door because I got to get in there. Like, where's your pets? Like, is everyone else safe? Is everyone tucked away? You know, like, just making sure that the scene is safe, really. And they sit with you and, you know, they just check in with you. And I think that they mostly just accompany you. And it's a really beautiful thing to be able to, you know, prevent some potential deaths. I think they've saved many lives that way. It is a wonderful service to be able to offer our patients.
I was on their website the other day and I noticed that they just opened a Spanish speaking line, which was really exciting to me because I've worked Spanish majority communities. So I think that it's a new thing. I think they're looking for volunteers still, but it's great that that exists now.
So this has all been really great. I just, as a primary care doctor, and I think a lot of our audience do a lot of primary care, I have to think of things that we should be doing anyway, things like offering pre-exposure prophylaxis when appropriate, or screening and treating hepatitis C, or appropriate immunizations would also probably fall under the umbrella of harm reduction. That maybe I'm thinking too broadly, but I'm wondering along those lines, are there any other sort of big, sort of easy targets that we can do as we're sort of thinking about just reducing overall risk in specific patients who have drug use?
Yeah, I think all of those things that you mentioned, I think making sure that it's, if, for example, hepatitis C, you know, aggressively treating, right? We're not like not waiting for someone to stop using, right? We know that treating people who are using is the way to cut, you know, to cut our transmission rates, like treating people who are actively using. Like people need to hear that. So I think those are wonderful things. I think making sure that we can encourage and talk to people about vaccinations for COVID, all our vaccinations, really. I do lung cancer, low-dose lung cancer screenings if I can. Just, you know, general primary care things that we know are gonna affect people that we care about and making sure that they're getting appropriate screening.
I imagine a lot of people who, for good reasons, have avoided medical care might not have gotten their pneumococcal vaccine or their flu vaccines or these kind of, especially if people smoke, like a lot of these very basic primary care stuff that we always want to take care of when we have people in the office. Paul mentioned PrEP, and is that something that we can offer people who are injecting? Are there guidelines on that?
Yeah, we definitely should be offering it. There are guidelines on it. You know, many counties remain at risk of HIV outbreaks in this country. And we know that there's many outbreaks all the time in West Virginia, in Boston, some recent places that people have heard about, Indiana. So it's really important to think about any person who's injecting drugs, any person who's mentioned sharing equipment in the past year or even recently to offer them PrEP, and thinking about their other risks for HIV as well, including sex work.
Dr. Kim Soo, you have taught us so much today. I'm hoping that we will be changing practices of primary care doctors out there and healthcare providers everywhere, where we can all integrate more harm reduction, both in the micro and macro level, into our practices. Do you have any main take-home points for our listeners today?
Some main take-home points that I'd like to emphasize are: believe and partner with people who use drugs, and learn from them and work with them. And it sounds really silly to say that after having so much medical training and so much school and then more addiction training, but really these basic principles of treating people with dignity and respect, believing their symptoms, these really aren't done in this country because we have this moralizing, punitive belief that substance use is a moral failing and people have done it to themselves. So really being the antidote to that and learning from and valuing the expertise of people who use drugs is one of my main take homes. The other is just that there are many, many strategies beyond abstinence that we can use to keep people safe and that people have been employing for decades. They have a lot of evidence, and really I want people to be thinking about, you know, how can I keep this person engaged? How can I keep them alive? How can I help them thrive? How can I help them achieve, you know, maximum health and a long life like everyone wants and deserves? Always prescribing naloxone. The street supply out there is deadly. It's toxic, right? People don't know what they're using, no matter what they think they're using. And so educating people, getting them supplies, getting access to their local syringe service program, fentanyl test strips, all of the things that we know matter to keep people alive and engaged with us.
Do you have anything you'd like to plug?
The National Harm Reduction Coalition Conference is happening in Puerto Rico in October 2022.
Very nice.
So I'm very excited.
If you are a clinician hoping to learn about harm reduction, it would be a great place to try to ask your institution or your community or just go yourself. I think there'll be a lot of great resources for people like you who want to partner and do research and learn and just soak up kind of harm reduction 500.
Great. Thanks so much again, Kim, for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
This has been another episode of our Curbsiders mini-series, The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine. Get show notes at thecurbsiders.com/curbsidersaddiction.
We're committed to providing you with high-value, practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or you can contact us at curbsidersaddictionmed@gmail.com. Special thanks to our partner ACAM, Dr. Matt Watto, Dr. Paul Williams for their support in this project.
A reminder that this and most episodes are available for free CME credit for all healthcare professionals at curbsiders.vcuhealth.org. All you have to do is create an account. Until next time, I've been Dr. Carolyn Chan.
I've been Dr. Paul Nelson Williams.
And I'm Dr. Natalie Stahl. Thank you for joining us today and letting us bring you pearls on harm reduction.
The Curbsiders Addiction Medicine is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only. The topics discussed should not be used to diagnose, treat, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity aside from possibly Cashlack Memorial Hospital. In short, we aren't responsible if you screw up. Please do your homework and let us know if we got something wrong.